And we're back at Tech Days Online, turning data into intelligence. Now, some people say that the very best product that Microsoft make is SQL Server. And some say that the very best version of SQL Server is SQL Server 16. And one of those people, I guess, is you, Mark.
Yep, that's right.
So, Mark, welcome. You're a new MVP.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. So when you initially spoke to me about speaking about a couple of my favourite things in SQL Server, I thought it's going to be a bit of a problem for me because the product is massive, a lot of the new features that are expansive, and I only have so much time in the day, so obviously I've not tried out everything. So what I've decided to do today, if it's okay with you, I've picked a small subset of my favourite things, and hopefully you'll enjoy what I've got to show you. One thing, though, I would like to tell you is that I wasn't particularly happy with the title. I didn't think it represented me enough.
Okay.
So I decided to call the session The Good, The Badass, and The Awesome.
Okay, that sounds good. Which one are you?
I don't feature on this slide.
Okay.
Or maybe the bad. And sometimes an ass as well.
Well, I've been there. I've deleted databases I shouldn't have done. So
here's a shameless plug for me. The thing I really want to try and promote, if there's any people in the UK watching, we've got SQL Saturday Cambridge running on the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th of September.
Yeah, but nobody's going to go to that because you've got that Buck Woody guy going, haven't you?
That's the problem, but we can never get rid of him.
Yeah.
So every time we run, he always wants to come over and speak. So. Yeah, that is a problem, but nevertheless, we're still going to try and get people to come.
Joking aside, I'm going to be there. It's going to be amazing.
You are going to be there, because I ask
Only
you every year.
I'm going to be there. I am going to be there. Otherwise, Buck won't get there, because he doesn't know the way now.
Right, okay. So if people want to come to it, then that's the community day is 10th of September, completely free, and the 8th and the 9th are the pre-cons, which are the things that help to fund the event.
Sure.
Not really much more to say about myself. I don't really like talking about myself, but I would like the audience to know that if they want to get in touch with me and connect, then my contact details are on this slide.
Okay.
So please feel free to get in touch. I may not be the quickest to respond to email.
Latency.
I definitely have storage latency issues.
Right.
But I will eventually get around to it.
Roger.
And. So we've had some awesome sessions today. Unfortunately, I've not managed to catch as many as I'd like because I've obviously been preparing for today, my session. But there is a particular session I'd like to flag up for tomorrow, and that's the Azure Stack and Container session.
Yeah.
I think I'm particularly excited about those technologies, and I would strongly recommend people.
Is that just an interest, or is that a really good home for SQL?
I will be talking about Azure Stack later on, and just touching upon it. But I think it's one of those things that I always wanted when Azure first came on the scene.
Yeah.
And I made the statement that why couldn't we have this type of Azure?
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what Stack is giving us now. So
okay, great.
I'll expand upon that in a bit.
Awesome.
So please see that session. Hopefully you'll check out all the others as well. So we've got a bit of a problem with SQL Server, or we have had a problem with SQL Server.
Totally.
Now, Microsoft have always tried to make their products very usable, very easy to install, and very user-friendly. The problem with that is it's always made us, the end users, think that the product is actually a very basic, simple product, because we can go end-to-end, we can run the installation wizard, and go from the beginning to the end, just accept all the defaults. And the problem with doing that, it gets us in a situation where maybe some of those defaults weren't the right thing for us to choose.
Yeah.
So the problem with that is it's resulted in us having various bad practices and misconfigurations. Now, it's not so much a problem to you when you first install SQL Server and deploy SQL in a brand new project, because it may be your transactional volumes aren't very high, your usage patterns are quite low initially. But as the years have gone on and SQL has expanded into this full-blown SQL engine, enterprise engine, and all the products that surround it, the misconfigurations have been exacerbated because obviously if something's misaligned, when you've got very, very high throughput attempting to go through, then we're going to have very bad performance.
Yeah.
And one thing I found, any of the critics of SQL Server, they've only been critics because of these certain bad practices and right. misconfigurations. They're fantastic for somebody like me who goes to companies and goes through the old, you know, cheat sheet of, yeah. of configurations, and I can make money from people deploying SQL mm-hmm. Server incorrectly, but it's not so good for the businesses that are rolling out SQL Server incorrectly. World exclusive on this slide as well. I don't know if you've noticed, but we've got the first ever picture of the boxed edition of SQL Server 2016.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So,
what does that look like? I can't really make. Oh yeah.
So it's actually a picture of a lolcat. The sentiments here are really my own, that I personally think SQL Server is pretty awesome now. Some of the functionality, a lot of the changes, we're truly moving towards a really good product. Well, we're already at the really good product stage. We're moving towards an awesome product.
Yeah. The things I've saw, I mean, I know we're not perhaps going to cover it here, but I fired up reporting services the other day. Oh, wow, what happened there?
That's right, completely changed.
Yeah, looks in a good way. In a good way. You know, hello, old friend. I mean, I was back in 2002 with that thing. I love that business. And, of course, I'm quite keen on the R integration thing, so I've got that working as well. But, obviously, for the purist, if you will, who's running this all against their transaction workloads and is worried about things like HA and performance and those kind of things, there's a load of goodness in there as well, right?
Exactly, yeah. There's been an awful lot of changes, which we will talk about. And I think really the key to, I mean, SSRS is a fantastic example because that was a key example of Microsoft listening to the feedback from the end users and the professionals as well. And this is one thing that has been really common, that a lot of the changes we're now seeing is due to the feedback of the professionals.
Yeah.
So the problem is we've now got SQL Server instance which has been rolled out, which has been misconfigured, and sorry, just excuse me a second, I'll just pull my mic out. So we've got these misconfigurations, and one of the problems with these misconfigurations is it's not so easy to change.
No, you'd have to do a reinstall, maybe detach the database, put it back in again, and that's going to be
sometimes, in a worst case scenario, yeah, definitely. I mean, there are the example that I'll be showing in a second will be tempdb. But changes and reconfigurations are possible, but why do we have to do it post-install?
Sure.
Maybe do it at install time. That's the best time.
I must admit, I always use, I realise I'm a bit weird, but I always use a script to do this with, and so I always end up with my SQL environment exactly the way that it should be. And then you would, you know, go and talk to a Mark, and if you're regularly installing this, you know, you would sort of sense check that and end up with best practice. And then maybe what we'd do is feed that back to the product team. So we should do that, shouldn't we?
Exactly. Well, scripts are fantastic, but scripts can also be, you know, they can also deploy misconfigurations as well. Mm. For example, if you were to generate your deployment script using all the defaults, then you're no better off than you were before.
Yeah. No, that's not what I mean. You know, I want tempdb on a different drive than my default installation for databases and log files.
Precisely. So that's a fantastic way to get over the GUI constrictions. So let's move on. So a couple of new changes in 2016. This may seem quite trivial to you, but to me this is massive.
Oh no, I get you. I mean, I'm a Windows Server 2012 guy after I was a SQL guy, and you know, this what I've got to install 3.5 SP1 every time I put SQL on here.
That's right. I mean, I use System Center myself, and the amount of VMs I deploy is quite high.
Yeah.
And every single time I deploy a new VM, I go to install SQL, and we're able to install SQL or run the installer anyway up to a point when it finally does that check and says, you've not got that prerequisite 3.5 .NET installed, which is a real pain. So the way around it, obviously, is you then have to go to PowerShell, run the add Windows feature command,
And the problem there is you potentially need the installation media or internet connectivity.
Yeah. And indeed, that whole thing then becomes a payload that I would have on a share somewhere and a script to run it against if I was back in the day. Yeah, because I think there was also this PowerShell hostility a few years ago. I hope we've got past that now. Yeah. But DBAs need to get frosty with that, I think, to do this sort of stuff. And then we could talk about desired state configuration as well. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit perhaps what we're going to cover some more of tomorrow. But, you know, we want our machines to be in a known state if we're going to run a mission critical workload on them, like SQL.
Certainly. Well, I mean, a lot of the old tools, such as cluster.exe, they've been deprecated now and deprecated for a long time. And I don't know if you remember DISM at all to add new features. Well, obviously, all that's gone away now. Just focus on PowerShell.
Yeah. Thank heavens, though. Those switches are awful.
Exactly. And I don't know about you, but this one's a bit controversial from what I've been experiencing. There's been some people not too happy about the fact that the management tools have been removed from the installation media itself.
Yeah, so I have very strong views about this as well. It's a little side element here, but I was filling in a forum question. This guy was complaining about the fact that the Xbox store was on his Windows server. And I said, well, the only way you put that on there is because you turned on desktop experience. You turned on desktop experience because you're using Windows server to look like Windows to your users. And I guess then it makes sense because they could be testing a game in the store. They could be. So for the rest of us who want to manage many, many servers rather than just one or two, we're going to do lights out management. I want the management studio on a machine. It might be a client machine, it's a VM itself, with my full workbench on there. And then over there, I've got my lights out server. So you know what, I've got Min Shell on there or No Shell. Why would I have a management studio on every server? It's about 10 times the size of the database engine for a start. It's additional attack vectors, it's more patching. So just get rid of that. You know,
exactly.
And manage from one place.
And just like the .NET framework, it's just extra bloat to our machines as well. So why do we need it? So I'm probably in the minority, or maybe growing minority, that is starting to think that, you know, having a management tool off the media is a good thing. And it's really a good thing from a Microsoft perspective because it allows Microsoft now to do more frequent release cycles with SSMS.
And I also, you know, moving that on a little bit, if somebody does remote desktop into a machine that's running SQL, if the management tools aren't there, there's not much they can do, even if they have the creds to do it. Now what are they going to do? So they need to be an expert user. So I really do think that we need to move beyond that and manage from one place and orchestrate from one place. You know.
And I think that's a good thing as well, not being able to manage from the server. If you have to be an expert user to do admin there, well, they're the sort of users we want to let loose on our SQL Server installations.
Yeah, if you can't, that's it.
and the greatest thing, so you talked about unattended installations. Yeah. The entire experience is exactly the same. So obviously now we've got some more functionality that we'll cover a few more things in the next slide. There are a couple more switches for you to remember. So I don't know if you just use a complete command line and type every single switch in place,
file. I did that, and then I realized that when you run the installation, it creates a file, and I can quickly dock to the file and then consume that. So
that's right.
You use the user experience once to set it up right, and then go again. I mean, I'd love them to do that more in like the Azure shell. Yeah. And if we're using Active Directory, you know, the same thing applies. You know, you do something Active Directory Administrative Center, and it you can save off the PowerShell the thing that you just did, and then you can put that in a script. I think that's the way to go. And I think that's been right for a long time, but you know what? Not many people know that.
No.
Which is why you're an MVP, and they aren't.
I use the configuration.ini file as well. It's a very easy thing to do once you know how to. So a couple of great things in the wizard, and these are really the things that I'm harping back to in my introduction of things that are missed generally by, you know, non-expert users. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, the more these get discussed, the more they become commonplace. But a lot of the time, these things are not getting deployed. So the first thing we're going to talk about is instant file initialization. As you may be aware, the log files themselves, as they extend, they have to be zeroed out. But data files don't have to be zeroed out, and this is where instant file initialization comes in. The problem is the SQL Server account needs administrative rights, or it needs rights to be able to do the instant file initialization. And,
yeah.
and what it does, it just pre-allocates the space, but it doesn't actually grab the space.
Yeah.
So it needs either to be a local admin, mm-hmm. or it needs the volume maintenance permission.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what we have now with the installation wizard. Let me just expand this out so we can just see a bit better.
Yeah.
So you'll see, I don't know if you can see, Andrew, but we've got we've now got a little checkbox which is it is not set by default, which I would argue that I would personally prefer it set, because we always want instant file initialization, apart from one scenario, and there's various security implications. If you don't zero out that data, then there may be certain information that you don't want to be presented to the database.
Yeah.
It would be, there are ways to get at that information. So it's
okay.
It's a security risk for really tight environments.
For most people,
not though. And probably the biggest change that most people are excited about here is the ability to configure the number of temp database files.
Yes.
So there always used to be recommendation from Microsoft, like one temp file per core. There's always this big discussion. And I think Kimberly Tripp really arrived upon what I consider to be a good figure. She wrote quite an extensive blog post on it. And if I remember correctly, I believe she said to start off with four and work up to about half of the cores. Because the problem is, if you think about modern day systems, we could have 128 cores, which is a ridiculous number of figures to have as files.
Yeah, absolutely. And those rules were back in the day. People still use them. But of course, what they forget is the architecture's changed as well now. And
precisely.
You know, that was in a world pre-SSD world as well.
And
other things have changed as well, like NUMA. And so you can't necessarily see those old rules apply. So I think put some science in it and learn from the experts. And again, Kimberly, another great ambassador for the MVP program.
And one thing to really state with, the whole reason we want more files in temp database is to get over something that's called PFS and GAM contention. If we only have one file, then there's awful lot of allocations that are trying to go to that one file. So we want this to round robin.
Gotcha.
So we've also got auto grow settings. The default sizes of TempDB are also increased from before. I would argue maybe not enough. And the auto grow settings have changed as well. The log file for TempDB used to be set at 10%, and now we have a definitive size. And I would say this is all good things, but now we have this in front of us, we can't ignore that these settings exist.
Exactly, it was just done for you and you had to go into the studio here. Oh, I've got to do something. So for the people who love UIs, they're going to have to type all this stuff in. And obviously if I'm running an installation script, I'm now going to set these parameters as part of my script.
Yeah, and the beauty is, as well, is that we're still trying to keep things simple, because what the installation wizard is doing, it's going out to look at the number of cores that are there.
Right.
And it will, by default, it will give you 8 files.
Yep.
But if the number of cores is very low, you don't need 8 files. Mm. What it will do is allocate the number of files that there are cores if it's less than 8.
Sure.
So we're still trying to keep the experience simple, but the information is there. We can't ignore it. And I think that's a great thing. And probably even better, there are various trace flags that have functionality now built into SQL Server, or at least the ability to set the trace flags via a different way.
Yeah, this trace flags was always, a sort of dark art, whereas people are used to, you know, also database, you know, actually doing it inside the command line and having to restart the service, which is what you need to do with trace flags, if my memory serves me
nearly correctly. I mean, most trace flags you do, some you could actually do on the fly, but a lot of the time the global trace flags would certainly have to be.
So being able to do some of this, you know, keeping the thing flying while fixing the engine while we're flying kind of thing is very useful.
Exactly. So let's talk about trace flag 1117. Now, going back to temp database and allocations, we have a situation where if we have data file growths happen, so if we've got a growth event, so a data file needs to grow, we have a problem that the other files are not necessarily going to grow.
Mm.
Is that really a problem? Well, it could be. It's a problem because if the files are not equal sizes, then SQL servers, I forget the exact description of this, but it has an logarithm to performance fill a logarithm, and it has this logarithm to determine which file it's going to take allocations from.
Yeah.
So if they're all the same size, we generally have the same amount of free space in every data file, which means everything's balanced.
Mm.
Now, if we get a mismatch in size, the logarithm will start to favour a particular file, and then we'll get file growths in a particular area. And remember, if we're favouring one particular file, what this means is we're going to get the PFS and GAM contention again, the allocation contention. So what we want to do is we want to make sure, certainly for TempDB, they all grow out at the same length. And 1117 was the flag, we always did that, but it was always an instance-wide flag. You turn it on, all of your user databases.
Of course, this is now at the database instance rather than...
And we may not want this. Now, it's definitely a good idea to have this for TempDB because obviously we're having a lot of allocations, deallocations happening. It's not necessarily as big a problem in other databases. So by default, the 1117 and 8 trace flags are turned on by default for TempDB. I say turned on, the functionality is turned on. If we want to turn that functionality on for other databases, then obviously we can use the alter database command. Now, 1118 is a particular, it excites me a little bit because I'm sad like that. I get excited over little things. So what we had, back in the day, you remember, we had mixed extents, which essentially meant that an extent is built of 8 pages, and we had tables sharing these extents. And they had to be quite small tables because when they got to a certain size, they had to have what were known as uniform extents. Now, things have moved on. We normally always have fairly big tables that will require uniform extent. The default behavior in SQL Server was always that it would do mixed extents, and even now today it still does. However, we can turn on for a particular database the mixed extent allocation or turn it off, and this will allow us to just allocate uniform extents, and this is a good thing for performance.
Right.
And probably my favorite trace flag of all and or implementation into SQL Server 2016 is trace flag 2731. So we have a situation where with tables, as you know, 20% of the rows have to change in order for the statistics to update. Now imagine if we've got a ginormous table. Generally in those kind of tables, there'll only be a very small amount of data that will be hot. And a lot of data that's called. So we're generally updating the same portion of that table, and it may not add up to 20%.
Indeed.
The problem with that is that statistics will never be automatically updated, which means our query plans will be suboptimal, or eventually will get suboptimal. What this functionality does, which is now inbuilt as by default in SQL 2016, for tables up to, I believe, 25,000 rows, it will still have a 20% marker on it. Beyond that, it will start decreasing the threshold for update. I've run into this myself in a company I'm doing some work for, and they were having a torrid time with performance. A particular plan kept regressing, and so I heard about this, and I said, have you heard about trace flag 2731? And We tried it out and in test, and it solved the problem. And by default now we have this, so we won't ever have to run into this problem again. So talking about query plans. Bit of a problem in SQL Server with query plans, because as I've demonstrated, they can change over time. There's lots of reasons query plans can change over time. And a query plan is what the query optimizer thinks is the most efficient paths of accessing that data. It's trying to get that data to you as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And therefore, it's building a plan, and it's building a plan based on statistics.
Yeah.
So imagine a scenario. Let's take a very big table as a good example. And there's a complete skew in the distributions of the data. So it may be, let's call it a name database. It may be we have one Andrew, and I would argue there's only one Andrew.
Well, not sure it's me, though.
But there are a lot of Marks.
Yeah.
So let's imagine that scenario. Let's say I run a query, and I as a search predicate, I will do a search for an Andrew in this very big table. And obviously, we've got indexing in place here. So the query optimizer looks at this, looks at the stats, and says, well, I've only got one Andrew. So from that statistical analysis, I'm going to do a seek for this. And it builds a plan. So we now have a query plan which is optimal for that query.
Yeah.
The problem with that is if that plan is now reused for a predicate such as Mark, where there's too many Marks in the world, I would argue. If it searches for a Mark and it tries to do a seek for every single Mark, I'm sending you to sleep, aren't I?
You are. Yeah.
So.
But I can see what you're saying. The data is affecting the query. It's not the structure of the data. The distribution of values in a particular column are throwing the query out.
So this is not good. So we've got a problem. And so when plans change, they could change to the wrong thing.
So we've got a good plan. We want to leave it like that, and it not to get too clever.
I would say it depends.
I work for Microsoft.
Oh, sorry. So it depends, and the reason it depends is which query is the one that runs the most.
Yes.
So let's say, for instance, the Andrew query runs, 99.9% of the time. Yet the Mark query runs a very small amount, but maybe one time a week.
But the other thing I think about where we're going with this as well is that obviously one area that SQL Server has been extensively used is to back off-the-shelf software, right? So you ship out an application, and you know the application designer is expecting this to work in a certain way and wants to kind of have some repeatable performance when the thing ships. You know, so you get this, I don't know, say it's an ERP system or a system for looking after schools or whatever it is. And so I can kind of see that if you have if you don't really want those plans to drift, you want them to be the way they are when they were shipped.
Yeah.
So that if in effect they become part of the source control and the application, then I can see that we would want to be able to have that and we control it rather than SQL second guessing it based off the data. Would that be a fair?
I would say so. I mean, there are obviously ways that some of the DB pros do today.
Yeah.
So, for instance, we can actually take samples of our procedure cache, plan cache, and actually save these plans somewhere else so we know what are the plans that are currently in use, and we can maybe even do some kind of change tracking. But I don't know if you've tried doing this. I have in the past, and it starts to get a little messy.
Yeah.
And it's not very easy to analyze these things, which is the key point. So. This is where we are today. This is where we're having to do our own thing. And when plans drift, if we have a plan which we think is optimal, but but is not being used for a particular query, and it keeps not being used, there are ways to fix that in place. So we can create what's known as a plan guide and essentially fix this plan against a query. That's always been a bit of a pain in the past to do as well.
And that's kind of the feature I remember that we used to have back in the day. Bear in mind, I haven't really been near SQL really closely until when 2012 came out, and four years is a lifetime, right?
So it is,
and even then it was a BI kind of play mark. Yeah. So
I had hair 4 years ago.
Right. I had no grey hair. No.
So yeah, that's right. So it's not very easy now to manage this.
So we've got a way of storing that now.
So now, as of SQL Server 2016, fairly excited about this feature. And the reason I'm excited is it's a fairly simple thing to implement. It's called the Query Store. Mm-hmm. And all we need to do is enable Query Store in a database. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can see from your seats on the slide here, but what we get is we get a brand new node just appearing in SSMS, which allows us to look at... all the various analytics for the query store. Mm-hmm. We can look on the properties of the database, and this is where we can do some management of the query store. And we can look at some lovely dashboards as well. So what, and I know you like dashboards.
Well, I do like dashboards, yeah.
So What Query Store is doing is it's going out there and it's doing what I've said, it's doing sampling, but it's doing it, I'm not doing it, it's doing it. And it will do it at various intervals that you tell it to do at the intervals, and it looks at what's known as plan regression. So if a plan starts to perform suboptimally,
yeah,
it will be tracking all this information.
So it actually knows how each one of these plans is actually being used.
Exactly.
And can see it drifting.
And it tracks over an axis of time. So we could actually look at a specific plan, and we could look within Query Store to see that a specific plan is taking most of the resources. It's the one that's causing the most, you know, heat on SQL Server. Yeah. And we can open up in the Query Store for this particular plan and see all the execution times it's run within a lovely graph. And it may be within this graph we will see a different a regression. So we could see different execution times. The beauty there is this will allow us to select the plan that we think is optimal and actually pin it to the query.
To the query, yeah.
Okay. Pretty much what I was saying I could do manually, but with a lot of effort. Now I can do it with zero effort.
Fantastic.
So Query Store is pretty cool. And if memory serves correctly, because I know there's quite a lot of discussion with the MVPs, there's some documentation put out to suggest that this was an enterprise-only feature.
Right.
And I think the MVPs weren't too happy about it. They were actually wrong anyway, because as I understand it, I hope I'm right here, having said that, I believe Query Store is available in standard edition.
So one of the things, obviously, to bear in mind there, it's only really as we get really, really close to shipping a release of SQL Server, one of the final things that happens, once we've done the fit and finish and got the features in, is to work out which features appear in which editions. And then we get into this whole debate about enterprise and standard, and I think the BI editions disappeared
That's right, hasn't it? But for not me, such a bad thing, I would argue.
No, but for me, the thing about enterprise is I don't mind if you're a one-man startup or whether you're, you know, some massive high street brand name. If you're running your business on SQL and if it's not working, you can't trade. That's why you need enterprise. It's not got anything to do with the size of the business. I know we tend to use the term enterprise to mean this big thing. Yeah. But imagine now you're just on the space shuttle off the enterprise instead of on the big ship. You know, life support is pretty essential on whatever size ship you've got. SQL Server is your life support system. You want that working. Therefore, you need all this extra stuff. And I know this is, you know, an area we're going to come on to in a minute.
Obviously, we have Azure as well for these small shops that they may want to test the waters a little bit.
Yeah. And you know, we've got Dev Edition for free now, Developer Edition.
Precisely.
So you can try stuff out. You can spin up a VM on Azure. You can see what you need, and you can justify the value. And oftentimes it is that the DBA wants to use Enterprise Edition, and then they're going to try and shoehorn their application and the SLAs into a suboptimal copy, and you end up maybe using third-party software and cludging stuff together and loads of scripts rather than just using the off-the-shelf thing. It's a little bit of a niggle for me, really.
Yeah, we're getting there. I think the voices are being heard there. So moving on swiftly. So we're talking about performance in-memory OLTP.
Awesome stuff.
Well, it is awesome, but this was really, it was like the flagship technology that was announced in 2014. I always had a bit of a problem with it, I have to confess.
No, it's fine. Because I mean, that's why we've got you here, Mark.
Obviously, hopefully I can come back again sometime.
No, you can, but I think it's important to share the your experience of using it rather than what it says on the flyer.
So, fantastic. It was a fantastic first step, but without doubt, there are lots of restrictions in place. So, it was only for those very niche businesses, those niche cases that we could implement in-memory OLTP, because one of the biggest restrictions is we couldn't alter in-memory tables.
Right.
So, what we would have to do to get around that is we'd have to drop the table. And before we drop it, we obviously have to export out
all the data,
which could be significant.
Yep.
And then drop the table, recreate it, pump the data back in. This is not really, it's not DBA friendly, let's say, for instance.
No.
So we actually have that functionality now in 2016 that we can alter tables. And that kind of procedure happens under the covers a little bit. Data is having to be shuffled around, but it's all transparent to us.
But it's got to be in memory, and is that to your point about the 2x memory there? Because you've got to have the old version of the table and the new version in memory.
Correct. So that's exactly where the 2x comes from for that. Now, there was also another problem which was connected to the fact we couldn't alter tables, and that was the bucket, creating a bucket count for our hash indexes. Right. So to explain, a hash bucket is it's essentially an array of memory locations, which are just a series of pointers to our rows. So when we have an index value, let's say, again, we'll go for names, Andrew, for instance, this may be hashed into bucket 2, and Mark may be hashed into bucket 3, but they may also be hashed into the same bucket. The hashing logarithm will is a randomized thing, but it will also repeat exactly the same patterns. Now, what we really want is to have a bucket count to accommodate our selectivity in our table for that index, so that we actually spread out all these values in different buckets. Because if I'm in the same bucket as you, and it will probably be as painful for you as it would for me. So if we were in the same bucket, one of us would have to be have a pointer to the other person.
Yeah.
And if you imagine a query, it runs and then it has to navigate these chain pointers to get to the particular value it wants. That's obviously not very performant.
No, no.
Now imagine I've got to do all this up front in 2014 because I've got to specify my indexes now because I can't easily alter my table. So my buckets are all created at certain sizes and I've got it wrong. So I can't change it without dropping the table. Performance is bad, I will have to drop that table.
Yep.
To and 2016, obviously, now we have the alter table, we can change buckets on the fly. In actual fact, just seeing my notes, we don't do that through alter table, we do that through the index rebuild command.
Right,
so anyway, so we get around that problem too. And there's various other restrictions that are being lifted. I mean, I would argue that the 2 terabyte memory in memory data support now is, for me, excessive because I've never come close to...
How many people do you know using SQL Server 2005?
Enough.
So imagine it's 2016 now, right?
Yeah.
So that's that, and that, if I do my maths right, that's 11 years ago, right? In 11 years' time, 2 terabytes, I'll probably have that on my mobile phone, right?
So
you see what I'm saying?
I do.
This is like a super.
I see. We're
now.
Future-proofing here.
We're future-proofing.
Yeah,
we need to.
See.
Yeah, who knows what we'll be what people will be stuffing into SQL Server in 10 years' time when it's end of life, right?
I guess so. So parallel plans was another problem. We always had to have serial plans before with in-memory queries, and also there's been improvements with the way that the data and delta files are managed as well. They're a lot more efficient in the deallocations. And also we have a lot more checkpoint threads happening because there was always a bottleneck, or there could be a bottleneck in a really active system. So we'll have one thread per file, essentially, in memory file.
Okay.
Yeah. So moving on, high availability now. So SQL XI, I don't know if you've heard about this functionality. Data files in Azure.
I'm going to put my hands up and say I'm vaguely aware that we can back off some stuff to Azure, some sort of hybrid play.
So I'm going to confess here. I'm cheating because this is available in 2014.
Oh, okay.
What it means is we can have an on-premise SQL instance, or even we can have an Azure IaaS VM with SQL running, and we can create a brand new database and store it in Blob Store.
Ah, yes, I didn't. Yeah, I know what you mean now.
For me, the two reasons I'm showing you this. For me, number one, I think it's insanely cool. And secondly, this is a prerequisite for 2016 file snapshot backups.
Right, okay.
And I recommend anyone listening today to go off and actually do some research on file snapshot backups, because if you are using that kind of deployment, it would make your life insanely easier.
Right, okay.
Quite an interesting thing that I was playing around with SQL XI is that I thought, well, let's try creating a file group. So we've got an on-prem database. Let's create a file group that actually points into Blob Store. Would it let us do like a hybrid solution there? So now I can have two tables, one in memory and one on-prem, and it works. So what that means now as a DBA is I could maybe have archival into Azure. Even in SQL 2014, I can do this.
Yeah.
And I can have archival into Azure, but there's a manual. It's a manual thing,
process.
Manual process to do.
Well, as we roll forward to today,
which leads us nicely on to Stretch Database.
Yeah.
Now, that solution I think is good in certain cases, but it may be we want something a bit more automatic. And Stretch Database allows us to take a database on-prem and just stretch it across into the cloud.
Yeah, and so the data that we're not using so often is going to sit in Azure. It's kind of super backed up, super highly available, and
precisely.
And we still get that.
And this may be our core data that we don't want. So as long as our queries are querying
mainly
our on-prem data, we're never having to touch that data again.
So the classic sort of compliance thing of keeping your records of 7 years kind of thing, this is a good play for that sort of stuff.
And beyond.
I'm just figuring.
Yeah.
Because most of the day we just need to look at current fiscal and...
Precisely. And it's incredibly easy to set up as well. You simply have to do an SP configure, do the remote data archive bit, and what will happen behind the scenes is once we've set a predicate for the tables that we want to stretch, this data will be automatically trickled across into Azure.
Yeah, just using sort of spare capacity.
And one final point on that is when you do have a query on a table and the predicate covers the whole data set, it will transparently go off into Azure and pull that data down.
So the query, we don't have to change
it. We don't have to change any of our code. You'll see it in the query plan that it's done it though.
Yeah, cool.
Cloud Witness. Again, I'm cheating. Sorry about this.
No, you're fine.
This is a Windows 2016 thing.
Yeah.
But since I'm a SQL failover cluster guy and availability groups guy, I need a cluster. Cloud Witness will allow me to simply does what it says on the tin, and for my cluster, though it's a prerequisite for both those two technologies, I can simply use Azure to put a witness in there. And remember, as of Windows 2012 R2, the suggestion is that you always choose a witness.
Maintain quorum. Yeah, the hell.
Incredibly cheap, incredibly easy to do and deploy.
Yeah, because it can be any old rubbish VM, right? It doesn't have to be some sort of big kick-ass thing, yeah.
Precisely. Read-only routing. Before, there was a problem in 2014 with read-only routing because, if you recall, it was only the very first read-only replica that would be queried. So what you'd get is a lot of clients going and doing read-only queries to the secondary replica, which would become a very, very hot server, and that would cause cause performance bottlenecks.
Yeah, and one of the things that people forget about availability groups and all this kind of work is that sometimes the offline copy can be more stressed than the primary.
And that can obviously have an impact on availability as well when that happens, because you don't want your primary speed to be slowed down by any process that it's trying to push things through.
Yeah.
So this is fantastic. So to explain this, all we need to do is we create a load balance set by putting parentheses around a set of server names in our read-only routing list, and then any read-only queries that come in will be balanced across these. Domain independent availability groups, I'm going to talk about along with basic availability groups.
Yeah,
you're pinching my what I thought. I only came here for one of those.
Well, you can have one when you go.
Okay, cool. So these two things. So basic availability groups and domain availability group independent clusters means that we can now get rid of database mirroring, which
it's gone.
I think is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much fun and games with people trying to get that thing. And as long as this is in the basic, the standard edition, then I think it's great that we've got the same way of doing things enterprise and otherwise.
And just finally, I want to wrap up and just say about Microsoft, a couple of technologies I didn't talk about today. The Azure Stack, I really think people should look at, because it means we can have Azure on-prem and SQL Server on Linux as well. My most popular blog post was about SQL Server on Linux on April the 1st, 2010. So we can do it for real now.
The penguin is in the room. I saw Joseph Chirosh, who's head of Cortana Intelligence, showing SQL 16 live running against a gazillion objects in the Worldwide Telescope. And it was, whoa, SQL, this guy, Linux guy. So we've now, Linux is our friend.
I'm a big fan. So, I mean, just to wrap up my stuff, I'm really excited about this. But as you can see, I've not even scratched the surface of the things that we can talk about. This is not even 1%, and I'm incredibly excited. And I recommend people go off, download the release candidate 3 and try it for themselves.
Right, so if those Channel 9 boys let us back on again, Mark, we're going to have to do more of this. It's coming out in general availability in June, I think.
June the 1st, I believe, yeah.
We did the launch a couple of weeks ago at SQL Bits, but if you weren't there, sorry about that. It was an awesome party. Mark, I'd like to thank you for coming along
thank
today
for
to whizzing through this stuff. And I think you're probably right. It's a badass edition of SQL Server. I'm looking forward to having a go with it. So that about does us for the day. Tech Days Online is the sort of whole turning intelligent data into intelligence. Hope you enjoyed that. We've got a completely different kind of, a much more professional show for you tomorrow. We've got Rick Hepworth talking about DevOps. Well, I will be helping him at the back of the room. He'll be out at front. I'm going to teach him how to tie a bow tie. It's going to be an amazing show. So please come back tomorrow and learn about that, because if you're into data, you also need to understand DevOps. I've been Andrew Fryer. This has been Channel 9.